Can I just welcome you all to this opening Battle of Ideas lecture, Rethinking Education, the New Crisis of Adult Authority in the Classroom. We're delighted to have an opening lecture. We haven't done this before. It's an experiment. But we wanted to kind of frame out some of the themes which we think actually run through a number of the sessions throughout the festival in terms of looking at the issues around authority. And who better to do that opening lecture than Professor Frank Faraday, who I'll talk about in a moment. So I'm Claire Fox. I'm the director of the Institute of Ideas. And we were very excited when we realised that Frank Faraday's latest book, Wasted, Why Education Isn't Educating, was being launched around this time, and we persuaded him to at least help launch his book here at the festival. Frank is a professor of sociology at the University of Kent in Canterbury. Many of you will have read his works on parenting, on therapy, on terrorism, but particularly on the issue of education, it seemed to us that many of the things which he's explored are things which we've tried to look at over the last 5 years at this Battle of Ideas Festival. And I have to say, the book doesn't disappoint. It really is a brilliant exposition of some of the things that are wrong in education without feeling that you're simply reading a Daily Mail whinge. It's actually sociologically sophisticated, really thought-provoking. I always think I agree with Frank, but I actually argued a lot with him when I read the book. It's well worth getting a copy of, and he will be signing it throughout the weekend at various times. But anyway, what we've asked him to do today is to kind of to look at a very specific theme of the book, which is the issue of adult authority. It's not by any means the only theme in the book, but it's one of them. He's already written extensively on this in the public arena. There was a big double-page spread in the Times earlier this week connected with this debate here, the Battle of Ideas. It's been previewed in the Times Education Supplement, in the Sunday Times, and this week the London Evening Standard, Frank had an article. And Frank has just been doing, on the Today programme this morning, again talking about the book. So I consider Frank Faraday to be one of the UK's, indeed Europe's, indeed the world's top public intellectuals. He's inspired the Battle of Ideas Festival in many ways. Let's hear what he's got to say. Professor Frank Faraday.
Yeah. Well, can I begin by saying a few things about why I wrote this book? Because it's not a book that I ever wanted to write, and I never expected to write a book on schools and schooling and the issues to do with the classroom. What happened was I was doing a talk in Amsterdam, and in this talk I was talking about some of the problems of intellectual life within the European context. And after I finished my lecture, a number of fairly elderly Dutch progressive educationalists came up to me and kind of grabbed me and said, "You know, Frank, you are the man. You've got to write something about education. In Holland, we're completely afflicted with worksheet culture." And when she used the word worksheet culture, I had no idea what that meant, because I don't, you know, hang out in schools all that much. And it really wasn't until my own son began to get bombarded with worksheets rather than books and brought home these things that you color in and you kind of give, you know, sort of yay or nay answers to, that I began to realize what they were talking about. And that kind of, that remark really, really haunted me. And I tried to kind of understand why it was that throughout Europe, education has taken this turn towards fairly narrow, technical, skills-oriented education. And there wasn't really anything new about that. And I said to myself, well, I got to look at this. And as I began to look at it, I began to get more and more drawn into the whole discussion. And I think I spent about 2.5 years of my life looking at pedagogic debates, looking at what different theories of education had to say about this. And I figured about a year ago that now is the time to talk about this, because it is a very important dimension of our experience that needs to be addressed. And it seems to me that one of the key questions that I think is particularly worth looking at is the issue of authority. And the reason why I think it's important is because if you look at all the debates that are going on about education, whether it's about reading, you know, what's the best way of teaching kids how to read, you know, whether it's about streaming children, whether it's about testing children, whether it's about bullying, all the debates, I would say, are issues where you can take one side or the other side of the argument. I think there's an honorable argument, an honorable pedagogic argument for virtually every position that's being put forward. And as a consistent humanist with a fairly strong liberal orientation, I wouldn't rule out any form of pedagogy. I think that at the end of the day, you know, sort of depending on the teacher, depending on the circumstances, depending on the children, virtually any form of pedagogy may work. I mean, I got strong views myself as to what I think ought to be the case, but I'm not going to insist that anybody else takes on board my particular take on how you teach children. But what I do think is non-negotiable, and what I do think is a big problem, is that all of these discussions and these debates that we have about education actually beg the question, which is, what is the fundamental issue that's driving these debates? What is the reason why it is that the content of what children are learning is really pretty sordid within a Western European context and in North America? You know, what is really going on there? And it seems to me that what underlies it all, it's a very simple, almost banal fact, which is that in contemporary society, we find it very difficult to give meaning to education. You know, we really find it very difficult to give education any kind of real meaning, any kind of content. And education is almost invariably approached from issues that are external to it and concerns that are entirely sort of external to it. And it's not really surprising because increasingly education, both the left-wing and the right-wing variety of education, is underwritten by this prejudice. And all the curriculum engineers informs us of this, as it was absolutely true. And the prejudice is that we live in a rapidly changing world. The world is changing all the time. And because we live in a world that has never changed as fast as it's changing now, all the conventions and all the practices of the past have become outmoded, outdated, or irrelevant. Time and time again, if you look at every policy document, it invariably begins with a statement, we live in a rapidly changing world. I mean, that's what it, you know, surprise, surprise, as if 100 years ago we lived in a steady state world where nothing ever moved. So we live in a rapidly changing world. And the minute you say rapidly changing, then that's a signal to tell you that everything from the past is useless. Everything from the past has become totally and utterly irrelevant. And if you look at all the current educational fads, they're all based on the premise that because we live in this radically new, digitally driven society, the intellectual and cultural legacy of human experience and the experience of grown-ups has become pretty irrelevant. Of course, the implicit message of that, and it's never spelled out explicitly, but it's there all the time, the implicit assumption is that adults have very little to teach children. That at the end of the day, adult knowledge is knowledge of the past. And it's quite interesting how children are being more and more flattered through suggesting that their values and their knowledge and their experience is more enlightened than that of their elders. I mean, every time I talk to an ICT teacher, they tell me, oh, these kids are wonderful. They're the digital natives that have picked up all this wonderful stuff that you and I as grown-ups are completely immune from understanding. Of course, you know that all the research shows that what most kids do is pretty banal on the computer. They're not exactly Einsteins, you know, sort of discovering a new world. But because we like to kind of flatter them, we kind of reverse the generational dynamic, and we think that we're learning from the kids. And, you know, these days, every time you see a government report on education, they will always have 10 children saying, children say, you know, we need more this in the classroom. We need more whiteboards in the classroom. We need teachers who are really clowns, you know, sort of rather than teachers. And you have the whole, I mean, who cares what children say? I mean, since when have what children say been of utmost importance in terms of what kind of education they say? But we're not allowed to say that. We've got to roll over and listen to the children's voice, you know, sort of. And by the way, the children's voice is usually officialdom's ideals recycled through the medium of children. And if you ever listen to what children actually say, the words and the language they use, you get the impression that somebody at the Department of Education, it's not called that anymore, it's usually called Department of Skills, Training, and Shining Your Shoes or something, kind of institute. kind of wrote for them. So that's the basic ideal. And it seems to me that what education increasingly does is it creates a mood of casual disrespect, both for tradition, but also for adult knowledge, adult experience. It's just kind of very casually dismissed as being of the past. And I was really struck by this. The other week, there was the Cambridge Review of Primary Education, and they made the point that all this educational stuff had to be gotten rid of because it was a bit like in the Victorian age, that somehow Victorian education, by definition, is bad. It's as old as Victorian. We've got to get rid of it. And the argument was, it's old, we've got to get rid of it. As it happens, the report contains some interesting ideas that I agreed with, but nevertheless, it did kind of convey this sense that, you know, it's old, we need a new education system worthy of the 21st century. So warnings about adult content have a different meaning in education than in the cinema. But nevertheless, what they are really adding up to is this idea that the past is the past and the past is a bad thing, and we need to get rid of that altogether. Now, often, these criticisms are merely old-fashioned, very conservative, Philistine dislike of intellectually oriented classical and theoretical knowledge. There's always been a section of the teaching community that hated culture, hated sort of classical education, hated a humanist orientation towards education. Now they've got a very good argument that justifies it, which is that it's irrelevant and outdated, and only information that can be applied and acted upon and can be used for training purposes is worthy of being taught. Increasingly, policymakers represent change as this omnipotent force that by its very nature renders prevailing forms of knowledge and schooling redundant. So one of the casualties of this idea that we live in a changing world is academic subject-based knowledge. That's got to go because, you know, mathematics and literature are old subjects. You know, they were invented a long time ago. Who needs old subjects? We need, you know, sort of multidisciplinary or aims-oriented education that somehow transcends the old kind of disciplines. And you'll find that increasingly the content of academic education is derided as is the academic subject. And therefore what happens is that the idea of rapid change sort of being so important creates a sense of instability within the educational system, where instability becomes the norm. And this instability is expressed through a series of educational fads. Every year, something new is introduced, followed by 20 reforms. And if you count up the number of reforms in education in the last 10 years, you know, you realize that they are actually quite sort of considerable. So basically, what I want to argue is that the dramatization of change within the Anglo-American education system renders the past wholly irrelevant. And more the past is denounced and rendered irrelevant, and more we're told how important change is, so what happens is that people become desensitized from understanding what is important about their own experience, their own past experience, that ought to guide their lives. And the constant repetition of the idea of ceaseless change tends to naturalize it and turn it into an omnipotent, autonomous force that subjects human beings to their will. And that's really more or less, you know, sort of how education is kind of influenced. It's a break and rupture before and after. That's the way that it's kind of dominated. And one of the most sad and tragic consequences of this is that this kind of imagination that is encouraged by this outlook leads and to the need to displace the old often overlooks important dimensions of historical experience that continues to be very relevant to our lives. The discussion of the relationship between education and change is frequently overwhelmed by the fad of the moment and with the relatively superficial symptoms of new developments. And often it's distracted from acknowledging the fact that the fundamental educational needs of students do not alter every time there's a new technology, every time there's a new social networking application that comes into being. And certainly, the questions raised in Greek philosophy, in Renaissance poetry, in Enlightenment science, or the novels of George Eliot, continue to be relevant for students in our time, and not just to the period that preceded the digital age. Now, in a sense, what happens is that by rendering change banal, we actually become de-educated from understanding what is important about change. The more we talk about change, and the more we naturalize change, and the more we talk about rapid change time and time again, and the more every shift in our life is characterized as a fundamental sort of change from the past, the more we lose sight of just what it is that is genuinely new and genuinely novel about our contemporary experience. That is why, although it purports to be a very radical way of representing human development, this is actually a very conservative, potentially very backward-looking way of understanding the way that quantity turns into quality, the way that there are distinct features of our own experiences that are unlike what has gone on in the past. We become desensitized from understanding it. And also, if we have this cavalier attitude towards change, then what happens is that the knowledge developed in the past, which is so important for society to face the future, becomes shallow, marginalized, and not properly taught and learned within educational institutions. What I'm really trying to argue in the book is that when change is objectified, it turns it into a spectacle that distracts society from valuing the important truths and insights that has been acquired in the best moments of human history. And yet, these are the truths that have emerged through attempts to find answers to many of the deepest and most durable questions facing the human species. Now, in one sense, it's quite embarrassing to have to argue this and these kinds of points in the 21st century. Because if the legacy of past achievements have ceased to have relevance for the schooling of young people, what can education mean? What can education be really all about? It's interesting because if you look at history, historically serious thinkers from across the left and right wing divide have always recognized that education represents a transaction between generations. I mean, after all, it was Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist thinker, who wrote that in reality, each generation educates the new generation. And it was Mussolini who put Gramsci in jail, who got carried away with rapid change, and who argued that what we need is this new progressive education, where instead of teaching kids these boring academic subjects like literature, Italian literature, or Renaissance poetry, we've got to give them what today we call a good skills agenda and make sure that they're training for the future. And that's what fascist Italy was putting forward. But it wasn't just simply Marxists who understood the importance of handing on the tradition of the past. Rather, from a conservative perspective, the English philosopher Michael Oakeshott concluded that education in its most general significance may be recognized as a specific transaction which may go on between generations of human beings in which newcomers to the scene are initiated into the world they inhabit. And the liberal political philosopher Hannah Arendt, whose work has really influenced my own work, wrote that education provides an opportunity for society both to preserve and to renew its intellectual inheritance through an intergenerational conversation. And that was seen as being pretty much self-evident by all the great thinkers of all the different political traditions, even when they were deeply hostile to one another on every other important matter. You see, I think it is given that one of the principal tasks of education is to teach children about the world as it is. Although society is continually subject to the forces of change, education needs to acquaint young people with the legacy of the past. Now, of course, the term learning from the past is often used as a platitude. It's often used in a kind of very casual way with a very platitudinous orientation. Yet, it is impossible to engage with the future unless people draw on the insights and knowledge gained through centuries of human experience. Individuals gain a knowledge of themselves through familiarity with the unfolding of the human world. And it seems to me that the transition from one generation to another continually requires that adults take responsibility for transmitting this knowledge in a coherent, systematic way. Unfortunately, we live in a world where curriculum managers find that kind of process almost antithetical to their very existence. And where they continually orient education in the form of training towards adapting to the future. It's all about adapting to the future. And the assumption is that the need to adapt means You mustn't have any strong views, any strong relationships about what has gone on beforehand. Now, the question that the balance of education should strike between orienting towards the past and towards the changing world is always and should always be a constant source of debate. But today, when policymakers and pedagogues tend to be so fixated with the present that they continually attempt to distance education from the past, it's essential to reaffirm the importance of a traditional humanist education. The impulse to free education from the past is actually influenced by the prejudice that regards ideas that are not of the moment as, by definition, old-fashioned and irrelevant. And here I come to a bit of my argument that I'm sure many of you will truly disagree with, but I think is actually quite central in terms of understanding how the education system works. See, the way that I see it, the project of preserving the past re-education does not mean an uncritical acceptance of the world as it is. When we talk about preserving the past through education, we're not saying that we simply accept the world as it is. What it really means is the assumption of adult responsibility for the world into which the young are integrated. It means taking ourselves seriously as grown-ups, and the experience that that kind of comes with being a grown-up in terms of past experience and carrying out that responsibility. The aim of this act is to acquaint the young with the world as it is so that they have the intellectual resources necessary for renewing it. Through education and through the education of the young and new generations, all the old important questions are re-raised with the young, leading to a dialogue that moves humanity's conversation forward. So the key point that I would emphasize in the book is that education needs to conserve the past. And I really insist on that because these days, even conservatives find it very difficult to really stand up to that point. I think all too often, conservatives who know better are very reluctant to understand the necessity of conserving the past. And that's really because in the 21st century, the conservation of the past is actually a very radical act. Which is why it's people find it so difficult to handle it. As Hannah Arendt argues, conservatism, in the sense of conservation, is the essence of educational activity. Right? She says very clearly, a liberal philosopher, conservatism, in the sense of conservation, is the essence of educational activity. Now, her objective was not to conserve for the sake of nostalgia, but because she recognized that the conservation of the old provided the foundations for renewal and innovation. The characterization of conservation as the essence of educational activity can easily be understood or misunderstood as a call inspired by a backward or reactionary political agenda. However, the argument for conservation is based on the understanding that in a generational transaction, adults must assume responsibility for the world as it is and pass on the cultural and intellectual legacy of the young. And interestingly enough, what Arendt argues is that in education, it's all about conserving, but it would be quite inappropriate if this orientation to the world occurred in public life or in other domains of human experience, where the last thing you would want is conserve. What you would want to change. But in education, this is the one sphere where the conservation of the past is the key accomplishment of a proper education. So an attitude of conservation is called for specifically in the context of intergenerational transmission of this legacy. Now, until recently, leading thinkers from across the ideological divide understood the significance of transmitting the knowledge of the past to young people. The conservative thinker Matthew Arnold's formulation, passing on the best that has been thought and said in the world, is virtually identical to Lenin's insistence that education needs to transmit the store of human knowledge. You couldn't be further apart than Lenin and Matthew Arnold, right, on most aspects of political life. But on this thing, they were at one, as were virtually anybody who could read and write until fairly recently. Today, that kind of standpoint is seen as being marginal and irrelevant. And I think One of the reasons why it does is because the approach towards education that seeks to conserve the past requires authoritative adult behavior. And I think what we're finding in the education system itself, but also in public life, is that adults find it very difficult to behave not as just biologically mature grown-ups, but actually as morally informed adults. I think that's something that's become very, very sort of difficult for them to do. And it seems to me that the principal feature of the new crisis of adult authority is the refusal to accept this responsibility. Now, you know, the exercise of adult authority has always been a difficult task. It's never been easy for a teacher to tell kids what to do, any more than it's been easy for parents to tell children what to do. It's never been an automatic process that you could just sort of kind of get away with. And adults have always had to struggle and fight to be authoritative and to exercise that authority. So in one sense, there's nothing new in that. But it's only in recent times that authoritative adult behavior has been systematically, culturally stigmatized and even criminalized. Right? It's only in recent times that adults have been forced to keep their distance from children. And not just physically keep their distance from children, but psychologically and morally keep their distance from children. It's only been in recent times that teachers in classroom have found it very difficult to discipline children and to punish children and to lay down the law. It's only been in recent times that a lot of teachers feel that they're the ones that are on the defensive when a problem arises rather than their students. So there's been some very important changes that have occurred. And under those circumstances, what you're beginning to see happening more and more, particularly in the Anglo-American context, but also elsewhere in Europe, is a self-conscious abdication of authority by a section of the teaching profession, where teachers almost self-consciously divest themselves from that authority and become their students' mates, begin to think of themselves as just learners. I mean, it's not very common to talk about yourself as a learner rather than as a teacher, and to begin to argue that hearing the student's voice in a school is really valuable, almost as valuable as what you've got to say. And it seems to me that what you end up doing is when you've got this self-conscious abdication of adult responsibility, you also begin to have a process, which I devote a few chapters in the book, called socialization in reverse, where instead of adults socializing children in the way that it's been classically understood, when it's grown-ups that basically impart to the young the experience of the world, what is right and what is wrong, how things ought to work, increasingly we are getting children to socialize their parents. And just this week we heard a story where one government agency was criticized for an ad that was designed to encourage schools to get their students to go home to their parents and to teach them how to behave properly in relation to the environment, because the argument was the parents were too stupid, too irresponsible, too sort of loathsome to be relied on to do right things. They needed an army of young 9 and 10-year-olds to tell them, sort of what is appropriate behavior under those kinds of circumstances. This is socialization in reverse, and we see it all the time. I mean, time and time again I'm told, you got to get the kids to show you how to work the computers. You couldn't possibly work Facebook on your own unless you have a 4-year-old kind of pointing it out to you. And people think this is very clever, and very, very good, but actually what they are saying is something that's fundamentally new in terms of human development, that the socialization process, which always required adults to take a role, it now has got this kind of reversal aspect. And under those circumstances, you will know socialization reverse doesn't actually mean that it's the children's values that are socializing us. All that it means, it's a number of officials, bureaucrats, and policymakers who are using children through which they recycle their ideas as a way of socializing their parents. Because, to be really honest, children haven't got ideas at that stage of their maturity to socialize society with. A liberal humanist education is underpinned by the assumption that children are the rightful heirs to the achievement and the legacy of the past. A liberal humanist education understands that if we don't act authoritatively as adults, we deprive children of their rightful legacy. We actually prevent children from gaining that legacy which they need to gain autonomy and independence, to be able to stand on their two feet. And it seems to me that if you do believe in freedom, and if you actually think that one of the roles of education is to prepare young people for freedom and to act freely and to be able to exercise their freedom, then that requires a more authoritative approach. Because without authority, you cannot guide, you cannot inspire, and you cannot lead. And unless you're able to do these three things, you cannot give meaning to the legacy of humankind, and therefore education will not be educating, which is the story of my book. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Frank. I'm just going to ask Frank a couple of questions, and I just mean a couple of questions, because that was a very rich speech, and I know that there'll be many people who want to either ask him questions or make points about it. But just one thing I wanted to ask you about, Frank. During the week, there's been a lot of kerfuffle about the number of false allegations against teachers in terms of the teachers' unions coming out and saying, you know, the problem with these pupils is they keep accusing us of molestation and so on. Because you were making the point about teachers have got matey with kids. But in some ways, there's a standoff between teachers and young people as well, which is they're almost frightened of young people. They see them as people who are going to make false allegations. There's a lot more expulsions in schools these days, particularly of primary school teachers. A lot of teachers are off on stress leave. We'll say it's because they're being intimidated by their pupils, who are often 10. And so on. So this idea of being matey seems to be accompanied by something else that's happening. There's also a crisis of authority, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because, as I said earlier on, there's always been a problem of discipline. But discipline in the 21st century is qualitatively different and has got different dimensions to it. So, for example, it is now the case that a growing number of children from primary school is being expelled. I mean, and this is an age, 6 or 7, where you would usually imagine that adults could manage their behavior. I mean, I've done a bit of work in school. I've never had a problem with a 6, 7-year-old. I might have had a problem with teenagers, but with 6, 7-year-old kids, if you can't handle them, there's some deep problem, a huge problem. But not only that, but these days, we're even expelling 2 to 4-year-olds, right? Can you imagine 2 to 4-year-olds in nurseries are being expelled for racism, for homophobia, for inappropriate sexual behavior? I mean, I did an interview with some people in the Northwest where a number of children who were 4 years old were expelled for attacking their teachers. Imagine a 4-year-old attacking their teachers and then expelling them. Now, why is this happening? Is it that children are on drugs? They're somehow become these demon-like characters? Or is something else going on? And what's going on here is that these are children growing up whose behavior is uncontained by adult authority. Right? These are 2, 3, 4-year-olds whose parents, you know, sort of when they kick up in a supermarket and yell, look at their shoelaces and are embarrassed to say, shut up. Right? These are the children who, when they go to nursery and throw a tantrum, the nursery workers, you know that it's too much of a hassle to lay down the law and tell them to shut up. You know, but these nursery workers, you know, will kind of look the other way. These are the kids that, you know, when they get hurt, when they're 2 or 3, know that their nursery worker will not put a plaster on them in case that's misinterpreted as abuse. These are the children that understand that there's a physical estrangement that occurred between their carers and them. You know, they know that they kind of pick up on that straight away at a very, very young age. And therefore, it's not surprising that as they get older, they don't think very much of the old people. I mean, if I was living in that world, I was a 6-year-old, I would think my teacher are sad as well. And I've talked to boys who are 9, 10, 11, and the language they use about their teacher, retards, morons, you know, idiots, you know, just casually come out. And I think, you know, this is what you get when you don't contain children's behavior by the use of authority. And I think we've created that crisis. And it's not that I'm a big disciplinarian. You know, I think that, you know, you've got to beat them up. But all that I know is that discipline has got a very creative dimension. You see, discipline is not just about telling people what to do. It's about teaching children self-mastery and self-control. It's about giving them the resources so that they can stand on their 2 feet and do stuff for themselves. And that's really what we're not doing in any kind of significant sense.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I suppose one of the things that people rather casually do when they have this discussion is to blame, you know, the kind of children's rights movement. You know, there's a kind of knee-jerk, often on the right, actually, but it doesn't really matter, we'll say, oh, yes, all those liberals who brought in children's rights. And I just wonder what you thought about that, because there are sort of interesting things like the fact that pupil voice is now mandatory in schools. I mean, you have to take consideration of pupil voice. And the whole notion of children's voice is now, actually legal and regulatory on the one hand. But there's also, I mean, I don't know if you saw yesterday, that Teenage Youth Parliament, which the headlines were Youth Put Adult Politicians to Shame. But I don't know if you heard any of those teenagers, but they were so anodyne and dull. It was frightening. I mean, it actually made the adult politicians look interesting, which is hard in Britain today. But everybody was kind of going around saying, aren't they marvellous? Nobody mentioned what they were talking about, which was things like, we want to be students and whether we want to pay fees. Or it was like sort of like self-referential. But everyone was like, oh, brilliant. So my concern is that these young people are being over-flattered by the pupil voice thing. It does look like children's rights gone mad, and that actually they do become potentially quite obnoxious in terms of young people, because we're turning them into self-regarding. But is that, you know, maybe that is just kind of middle-aged, oh, God, the youth are driving me mad point.
Well, you're always going to be worried about being middle-aged, because
it's a particular preoccupation of mine.
It's not a nice period in your life necessarily, but you've got to learn to live with it. there is a problem, and the way that I experience the problem is that if you're a university lecturer, if you teach in a university, we're now going to have a new rule whereby students, university students, will be peer reviewing your lectures and everything else. Now, I have to tell you that the idea that somebody, a student, peer reviews my lectures, I just think it's idiotic. Right? I'm not really interested in the views of my students about the quality of my lectures for a very simple reason, that education is not like singing. You know, like young people are very good at judging good music from bad music. That's their thing. But when you give a lecture, you often give lectures, and you often teach children as well, about things that go against their instincts. In fact, quite often, you know, as a good teacher, you have to do things to kids that they don't want you to do, and they're not going to like. You know, I never met a young child who really said, all my life I was hoping to memorize the timetable. This is like my dream come true, right? I mean, nobody does that. Nobody, you know, sort of enjoys, you know, learning handwriting. You know, sort of. I mean, you know, a few sad kids do, but most people often find that these things go against their grain. Now, that's the thing about education. Often forces young people to do what they don't want to do. And that's one of its kind of features. And, you know, at that point, you know, you assume that you know what's in their interest. As an adult, you know what kids need, right? And you act upon that. And you do it as a parent and you do it as a teacher. And therefore, obviously, the whole idea of a student's voice is nonsensical. And in fact, in my book, I argue that the use of student voice is first of all, not the product of liberal child rights advocates, although they push it and they're, in one sense, responsible. It's a symptom of the collapse of adult authority, where adults are so scared to speak on their own on their own behalf that they've got to find somebody else to say it for them. Because, actually, the use of student voice is a form of micromanagement of teachers. I mean, student voice is a way of keeping teachers in line. And as you might know, in some schools now, they have 13, 14-year-old kids on the interview panel when somebody is being interviewed for a job. So imagine you're a maths teacher, and you know, you're trying to teach maths to these kids, and you got some precocious 14-year-old that can barely spell the word math, you know, sort of interviewing you. And you know that your future depends on having to please, you know, sort of this particular kid. You know, it does lead to a very kind of weird idea. And, of course, when you are so worried about the opinion of the kids, then the way you teach, you know, sort of accommodate that. You begin to flatter them. You end up making a lot of jokes. You end up being flippant. You end up being matey with them. And all these negative traits that we see, particularly in the younger generation of teachers, are really their survival tactics in a world where they got to pay attention to their clients rather than to their students.
And just the final thing then is on more on that crisis of knowledge that you talked about and the need to conserve the past as a radical act. The thing about the curriculum, though, is how do you avoid in that the idea of a curriculum fixed in aspic, as it were, that can never change with no flexibility? I mean, even the curriculum, the great humanities and sciences and so on of the past were contested. It's not as though, you know, the canon of great literature, there were some things that probably should have been on there that weren't on and things that were on there for all sorts of wrong reasons. And how do you move forward? Because there will be new knowledge. I'm arguing with myself in saying this, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, there will be things that we couldn't have imagined we would need to study. You know, it does sound fixed, and it does sound as though you can't ever expand knowledge from what you're saying.
No, I mean, I'm a pluralist and fairly radical about the curriculum, and I've got no problem. If you want to teach media studies to somebody else's children, that's fine, right? I've got no problems with that, you know, sort of. And as it happens, you know, sort of, I can live with, you know, all kinds of curriculum innovation, and nor do I think that that the content has got to stay stable, right? I'm quite open to that. As I said earlier on, there's numerous ways of teaching and educating children, and I think we should be open to those possibilities. In fact, one of the problems in England is you don't have enough different kinds of schools that try different ways of teaching children. I think that, you know, I'm really open to all of those ideas. As it happens, my own personal view is that today, because there is such hostility to any education that is abstract, theoretical, intellectual, classically oriented, I do want to take a hard line on affirming these. Because I do think it's important that, you know, sort of, I would like to see more children learn Latin and Greek, and I'd like to see more children learn history, proper history, not, you know, about the Second World War kind of history. And learn proper literature, learn grammar, right? But at the same time, I can live with, you know, the innovations of all sorts. And I think that there's a time and a place for everything. And I think in that sense, the issue is not really, you know, sort of having a one-sided, you know, sort of stereotypical view about the curriculum, but understanding that the curriculum has got to have intellectual content. As it happens, I've seen media studies courses that do have intellectual content. You know, not every media studies course is moronic. I mean, a lot of them are, but some of them are really good. So it's really a question of the content of the curriculum rather than what the particular subject is.
Okay, thanks. So just to sort of remind you that this session is actually supported particularly by the ESRC, the Economic Social Research Council, and I know that they have been also our school pupil champion, and there's quite a lot of sixth formers in, so they might be mortified by some of the things that have been said. The Institute of Ideas Education Forum are also the partner, Professor Dennis Hayes's team, and there's I know lots of teachers here, and everybody in between. So now is your chance to challenge the authority of Professor Frank Furedi, so do not hold back or take that he is right as given. Okay, I've got a number of hands. Who are my microphone people? Okay, so can you come to the front, and we'll have this person here first, and then that lady there, and then that gentleman there. We'll take groups of kind of three or four, and then I'll come back to Frank. Yeah.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions. The first is really, I really like what you're saying about the idea that we, by not kind of holding on to history and teaching the past, then I think really we're letting go of the future. And I was wondering if you could say something about how that ties in with the focus today that in teaching around morality and behaviour, because it seems to me that because we're actually only talking about the present all the time, what gets left is not really just skills, but it is around kind of emotional behaviour and morality. That seems to me what gets taught in schools. And then the other question I had is that you seem to present this idea that the children are out of control, that somehow they're kind of powerful now in relation to the adults because the adults have lost authority. But then the other side of that is this idea that the children are in fact very, very vulnerable. And whenever adults do try and express any kind of authority over children, we're actually told by experts that that's going to challenge the child's self-esteem and basically damage the child. So I wondered if you could say how that fits in.
Okay, thanks. This lady here, this gentleman, and then Frank, pick up anything you want.
Thanks, and thank you for a typically interesting talk. It seems to me as I listen to this, and I'm talking from the American experience, which may not be completely relevant to all of you, that you've described one strain in education, but I see it coming in collision with other strains, and partly around authoritarianism that Claire referred to. We see so many children being expelled or suspended, not for throwing tantrums, not for being disruptive, but for completely innocent behaviors, for bringing, we had a case where a second grader or a first grader was suspended or expelled for innocently bringing a Boy Scout knife into school. I mean, we have cases where children are being treated like little terrorists. So this is not, I just want to stress, this is not a benign view of children. We also, you can talk about the children's rights movement gone mad, but at the same time, we have a serious restriction of student speech rights, especially in grade school and in secondary schools. We have where students are losing rights, losing speech rights that they had 20 years ago. A lot of this has to do with post 9/11. A lot of this has to do with the fear of violence in schools, that we have these zero tolerance policies so that children are treated not as little receptacles of authority, but as I say, as little terrorists. And the other point I wanted to make was that while it's true that there's a lot of trendiness in curriculum, one of our problems is not the urge to get rid of the past, but the urge to conserve not the wisdom of the past, but the myths of the past, because some of our biggest curriculum battles are still around teaching evolution. So there are, I think, a lot of strains that are colliding with each other, at least in the U.S.
Okay, so that's Wendy Kaminer, who's come all the way from America to speak on the Rethinking Freedom panel later on today. And then final point, and then Frank, pick up anything. I know there's a lot of people.
I think a lot of your middle-aged audience would agree with your identification of the erosion of adult authority. And progressive erosion of adult authority. And I've just got a simple question, and that is, how do you see the future turning out? Is this erosion going to continue, or is there a way back?
Okay, Frank, lots there.
Yeah, but actually quite related. Just to pick up on Wendy's point, you see, in England we've got exactly the same problem. We have unprecedented number of kids being expelled from school. Again, for trivial, I mean, when you expel a three-year-old child for homophobia, right, or for inappropriate sexual behavior, then quite clearly what we're saying is that we cannot handle these kids. We cannot manage these children, and therefore expulsions become a way that you find an organizational solution to the problem of authority. And I think that many of the expulsions in our educational systems are the result of the fact that the usual way of managing children's behavior don't seem to work because you're not able to act authoritatively, and therefore you rely on administrative and organizational solutions or drugs. These days, any boy who is a little bit active, we give them Ritalin, And I know that, if I had been around now, I would be on Ritalin all the time because I used to find it very difficult to keep still, and I would be diagnosed as having some kind of one of these millions of new diseases that children have. So, what I'm trying to say is not that we have a benign view of kids. I think that the collapse of adult authority does not lead to a benign view of kids. It leads to a view of children that is morally disoriented. It's one where, on the one hand, we assign to them some of our own power, but at the same time, we also view them as threats. I mean, deep inside, adults are scared of children because we don't really know how to have a conversation with them. And that's why you have this, what, Sally, what you were describing, the schizophrenia of vulnerability, of a child that is powerless, impotent, you know, sort of kind of child that cannot cope with anything, whilst at the same time we have the celebration of their voice, which is entirely rhetorical. I mean, I think virtually everybody I know, even the worst New Labour, you know, sort of promoter of the children's voice deep inside, knows that this is just a ritual. This is just, pretty much an empty kind of ritual as a way of them avoiding responsibility, you know, and for doing things. So I think this is got to be seen in that kind of a way. And I think you said something about the fact that education is often about morality. Well, I think that what's increasingly happening, I mean, America is very different in this, because in America, you know, you still have people who have moral talk about them. Here in this country, even religious educators find it very difficult to speak the language of ethics and morality. And therefore, you will find that they quite often will go for the pedagogic quick fixes themselves in the way that they manage with these things. And I've been very, very surprised how the idea of communicating values in a religious school setting has given way to what is the dominant way you deal with this in Britain, is values clarification. I mean, that's what has become. Values clarification means I haven't got a clue what my values are, you know, but you as a child, you can, you know, you can decide for yourself, you know, what it is, you know, and that's all it is. And it seems to me that you ask the question, is this going to get better? I think it's going to get much worse, without a doubt, because all the political parties have the same educational policy in this country. There's no difference between any of them, as far as I can tell. I mean, only on the margins, which is unfortunate. Although I don't think any of them will be as bad as New Labour. I think that's a class. I think what they've done in the last 10 years is in a class of its own. So it's going to get much worse. But I do think there's a cohort of adult parents and teachers who are aware of what's going on. And I do believe that in a relatively free society like ours, you can mobilize them to sort of act on their own instinct. But it's going to be a really major struggle. I see my job at the moment is try to get more educators to say in public what they know in private and to be a bit braver and to address these things in a slightly more grown-up way.
Okay, thanks. So I've got right at the back, just to kind of start there. Yeah, you, sir, and then I've got two ladies there. Yeah.
Thanks. It was just an observation and a question, really. First is that the change-oriented curriculum really provides a very unsatisfactory resolution at the moment, because it seems to me that what you've got is a challenging of adult authority, but also a widely held perception that that's a problem. It seems that a lot of people feel that schools are dysfunctional at the same time, and that there is a crisis of adult authority. So it seems, I think, the two things coexist at the moment. I think often what that means is that there's a widespread negativity about anything being achieved in schools, and they can almost become a metaphor for all kinds of decline, which does put you in a very difficult situation. And I just wonder, kind of moving forward, do you try to restore adult authority through discussing adult authority in its own terms, or do you try and exemplify that through saying, well, this is the type of knowledge that is useful to young people? Because it does also seem to be a widespread perception of that crisis as well.
Okay, thank you. So I've got two ladies there. Yeah.
Hi. I am the mother of a five-year-old who's on the Eco Committee, so I'm obviously being socialised into how to be environmental. But I'm also studying early childhood studies, and one of the things that has been coming up a lot in discussions, and I think that the lecturers are very, very excited about, is the Reggio Emilia system in Italy. And it was very interesting that you talked about Mussolini, because it came out, it was an idea that came in opposition to fascism, and this kind of idea that we've been so horrible to each other as human beings that what we need to do now is find spirituality again and find what is good about humans and do that through the Reggio Emilia system. So the whole system, I mean, it kind of fits into what you're saying, because the whole system is about let the child lead and don't give any strict sort of criteria, but the child is followed around by an artist who then kind of expresses this child's ideas, and everyone is very happy, the whole community are involved, and, you know, what a lovely place this village in Italy is. But the other system that's very, very popular at the moment is Steiner, which again came out of a period that where people were very unhappy about what we were doing to each other as human beings. And again, it's very much focused on, with Steiner, his ideas are that, you know, you've got to let the child move till they're about six, and then they'll settle down and sit down and listen to you as adults. And then you keep the same teacher, because obviously children need that continuity. So what's very interesting is these things are said in terms of, you know, let's look to the past and find out what's good about past systems. So it's kind of almost like, you know, let's kind of see what's good about past systems and hold on to the past and hold on to our histories. But at the same time, they really dislike modernity. They really dislike the idea of television. And particularly Steiner thinks that, you know, all our children are ruined by television, CD players, anything that that comes out of modernity. So it's weird in a way, because it's saying, like, we'll deal with the modern system by introducing these kind of systems that put the child at the centre, and the child as a co-constructor is a very popular word. But at the same time, they really dislike the modern world. So I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Okay, person next to you. Can I just have just put your hand up if you want to speak. You speak. What?
Okay. I thought the book was really good and really explained the, you know, that central idea of the loss of authority and its effects in social life and in education in particular. But there are two areas that I thought needed developing more, and one. I think sort of really came into sharp focus the other day. I was at a debate in Cambridge, and the person sitting next to me asked me what I was interested in researching, and I told her I was interested in looking at, you know, the idea of academic, traditional, liberal education and knowledge and, you know, motivation in classrooms. And she looked at me really sniffily down her nose and sort of said, but, you know, that kind of knowledge you can look up in the Wikipedia. And this was you know, a professor at Cambridge in the science department, and it struck me then that knowledge is not just derided, as you say, Frank, but it actually isn't really understood at all, and that's amongst educators themselves. And that was one area that I thought needed developing more. This is, you know, I think we need to develop a more detailed description and analysis of why a liberal education, well, what it is and why it is better and potentially more powerful than any other type of education, including emotions as a basis for organising education socially. Because I do think that without that, teachers will not have authority, because they have no other source of authority in the classroom other than what they know. And if they don't really know that terribly well, then they're going to feel a lot more insecure and try various other tricks that are offered to them, or just sort of thinking on their feet. And I think, you know, without that, it does tend to be a little bit, to say we value knowledge and education for its own sake, I don't think it's quite enough. I think we need to go further and say why it's better. The second point is, it's contradictory as well. I'm sure, you know, you wanted to focus on one thing in the book, but the structural things, the kind of structural changes in education and the standards agenda often work in contradiction. So at one point, you make the point people are educators, you know, they kind of are reluctant to identify gifted and talented people in, you know, that's this scheme that the government's rolled out. But nonetheless, it is an initiative with pots of money, so schools do it. And what you then get is a complete mess with, you know, a gifted and talented child in one school getting a special notebook. In another school, they get taken on an outing. Neither case do the children know why they've been identified as gifted or talented. So it does become an incredible muddle. A final question.
Really quick. There's loads of people who want to speak.
Talk about a rent. You mentioned the fact that you can have hierarchical relationships in education on the basis that in adult society you've got equality. But is that still the case? Is there still an ethos of equality in adult life today?
Okay, now, there's lots of people who want to speak. So, the gentleman with the purple shirt on next. Then after that, Professor Dennis Hayes is just in front of him. Then Frank. Then some more points, but people do keep them quick, please.
I was a lot in sympathy as one of the middle-aged and more people here. I was a little surprised that you didn't mention the role of the government in terms of what I see as undermining the authority of teachers by imposing its own authority through the national curriculum. I recall many years ago, as a teacher and as a head, that in effect we, using the past strands of education in different ways, we authored, and I'm very interested in the relationship between being an author of education, where you work out your own ideas, philosophy and practice, and authority. And it seems to me the two go together. And I'd be very interested in your view, Frank, about how the imposition, as I see it, of the government agenda through imposing its own authority.
Okay, thank you. And the person just is actually just next to you there in front, yeah.
Dennis Hayes. I've just got to make the criticism that a lot of people would make of such points that you've said about lack of authority, that most teachers actually get on with a good job. They actually do what you say they should do. There's, I mean, some of the anonymous people who've spoken in here, Toby Marshall, Mike Taylor, Richard Swan, whose voices I recognise but weren't confident enough to name themselves, which is always a useful thing, actually do teach really well, and there's a lot of good teaching going on, and you're describing something else and ignoring the fact. Though you're right to say they don't speak up. Perhaps they should speak up more. But I was talking to some students to show the disastrous effects of this on them, to, I mean, 14-year-olds, pupils rather than students, and asking what they thought about the number of adult authority figures who go into schools, police officers, fire officers, social workers, a whole range of people who are supposed to be in authority. And they had nothing but contempt for them, their attempts to assert authority. But one particular young girl gave me this phrase, which she felt about the result of all this on her schooling, that she was on a road to nowhere, that there was absolutely nothing being offered her. And her phrase, that I was on a road to nowhere at 14, I mean, it shows that it isn't a beneficial thing in the way that Wendy may have got the impression, but something appalling. But it does seem, the real question is, aren't you exaggerating, that there really is still the transmission to future generations going on, and the real problem is not that it's not going on, but that teachers refuse to articulate that transmission.
Okay, thanks. Frank, anything you want to pick up?
Yeah, I really agree with that point about the national curriculum, not because I would necessarily rule out a national curriculum, but because the national curriculum in this country works in such a way as to undermine the use of teachers' professional judgment. And it seems to me that the key issue about authority is the exercise of discretion. In order to be able to exercise discretion, you need to feel authoritative. To make a good judgment call or a difficult judgment call, you need to have the confidence to make that judgment call. And if you don't have that confidence, then you will find it difficult to make those difficult judgment calls, and you will then follow the curriculum, which is more or less really what's happening here. And I want to make this point very clear, because to me the authority issue is not predominantly about discipline. It's really about how you teach, you know, because authoritative teaching requires the use of discretion. And the reason why I want to insist on this point is because in the literature, a lot of people counterpose freedom to authority. You know, it's like a zero-sum kind of relationship, whereas I would argue that it's through the exercise of authority that children will learn to understand the meaning of freedom. It's through the interaction against authority and in relating to authority that ideas about freedom and potential become tangible and real in the experience of young people. And that's what's quite important. In terms of exaggerating, I this is a very difficult question, because a lot of people have told me who read my book or drafts of my book, they said, completely agree with your book, but there's some wonderful teachers around. And I know that a lot of new Labour ministers always say that teaching has never been as good now as before. They say we live in this incredible world of fine teaching. My own experience, and this is not based upon proper empirical research, and therefore I'm prepared to be convinced otherwise, is that in England, teaching is terrible, right? It is terrible. I mean, and I can see that, for example, when I see Australian or South African or European teachers in the classroom, the way they handle children, compare them to especially young English teachers, they're in a different league, right? I mean, despite all the techniques and everything else, I think teachers' training in this country has got to be the first institution that needs to be tackled. I think teachers' training is horrible, you know, sort of, and even really smart, inspired, talented young people who want to become good teachers, you know, do get de-educated or their intellectual confidence undermined by the way that they are trained. So I don't buy the idea that there is this wonderful posse of teachers out there. Obviously, you know, the generational transaction still continues. I mean, you know, there are a lot of committed teachers out there, you know, who are doing this thing. So I'm not buying teachers. All I'm saying is that on balance, compared to the amount of resources that we're putting in there, teaching is terrible. You know, Russell, what's Russell's first in the philosopher? Bertrand Russell, in his very first read lecture, you should read it, it's a wonderful read lecture, makes a very simple point. And the simple point that he makes is that you can distribute resources very easily, pounds, you know, sort of physical resources, that easy to distribute. But ideas and cultural capital, you cannot just simply, you know, sort of distribute in the way that the government tries to do. And they're trying to improve teaching by putting money into it. Well, you cannot make people smarter, cleverer, more intellectually curious just by throwing money at it. The way you do it is by raising the cultural capital of this country, which is why, at the end of the day, the way we solve this problem, as somebody asked, is by attacking knowledge and raising the issue of knowledge, but not by putting more money into it. I'm not against more money into it. I like to have a better salary, but that's not going to make any difference. But by understanding that, at the end of the day, this is a cultural accomplishment rather than something that you achieve through finance.
It is given that the Institute of Ideas Education Forum teachers are an exception to this rule before any of them tell us otherwise. We know that. That's not the point. Talking of which, in the middle there, and then there's a couple of people I've got in the middle. I am coming up. Yeah. Yes, you, sir.
Hi, David Perks, so Dennis knows who I am. I think one way of looking at this, and I think it came from a comment over here, is that when we think about education, especially if you're kind of on the progressive side of education, you see the past and the curriculum of old as a blockage, as a stultified dead facts. And the critique that's used against that is to say, well, what we want to do is get kids to think. We want to teach them to think. So that is what teaching has become, teaching, thinking in the abstract without any sense of any content. And that is now the way that new young teachers who really want to give it a go experience the idea of teaching. They want to jump over the idea of a child not knowing anything to try and somehow implant in their minds this critical intellectual thought processes without actually having to go through the work of educating them. It's education without educating people. But the problem with that is the end result is banal. There is nothing there. There is no content there. There is no ability to think beyond that. That, I think, is a really powerful critique that we can use to attack this idea that somehow the past is worthless and doesn't contain anything worth knowing. Because without content, we cannot learn to think.
OK, so I've got lady there with red has been very patient. Yeah, yeah. There, yeah, yeah. Then there's a lady there, and then there's a lady there, and then there's a lady there, and then we'll see. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask Frank about the resolution of some of this. One of the things that happens in America is you have the Latin schools, which are schools which tried to go back to a more classical curriculum, and they teach Latin, obviously, and they teach rhetoric and all of that kind of stuff, which is a much more old-fashioned curriculum, and it's quite a... it's becoming a more kind of popular movement within, say, the charter schools. I wonder, I'm really just asking, whether you can simply address the problems that you're talking about in terms of adult authority simply at the level of curriculum, because what strikes me when I go to see those schools is, although they're, you know, they've got a very, very interesting curriculum, it almost seems as though it's a curriculum that which is being done by rote rather than having any real substance behind it, because the lack of the sense of authority that not just the teachers have, but why they're teaching this stuff seems to be missing. And I wonder whether it's possible simply to address this at the level of, say, curriculum, or whether it does have to be made a more conscious recognition of the problem of adult authority.
Okay, thanks. And there's that lady there. Yes, you.
Thanks very much. I found your speech very interesting. I'm a secondary school teacher and middle-aged, so I've really got nothing going for me at all. Really what I wanted to say was I don't understand really why you're optimistic about the future, especially given what you said about the younger generation of teachers and teacher training, which I think is in a terrible state. It's all about expectations, but not about what you do when students don't meet your expectations. But also, particularly the issue of senior management teams, who seem to be more lily-livered and more terrified even than the classroom teachers to have any authority or to challenge parents. I don't want to go on too long, but to me that seems like a major issue in the whole discussion of authority in schools.
Okay, thanks. And then this lady here, yeah. Just a bit in front. Then that lady, then
just
Frank,
one
then a couple more.
Yeah. Short question. In Germany, maybe we're lagging a little bit behind in some of these trends that you describe. But one thing that's happening at the moment that I find really very alarming is that teacher training is being reorganized. And what is happening, whereas in the past, when people trained as teachers, be it maths, Latin, whatever it was, the main thing they were expected to do was to be extremely good in their subject. And okay, they did get a little bit of training, of course, in some kind of pedagogical subject, but that was really subsidiary altogether. And they're completely turning that round now. They want to change the time devoted to these kind of acquiring the faculties of being able to relate to young people, give that much more time than the actual firm studies of the subject concerned. And I think that's completely wrong. And I'd like to know from you, from your experience here in England, how you look at that.
Okay, so this lady here, while she's speaking, can I just see, I've got you two gentlemen and that lady there. Is there anyone else? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, hello. Somebody asked a question earlier about what is the way back. And I think perhaps we should consider what is the way forward. We haven't really talked very much about parents in all this, and parents, given the choice, for example, in the private sector, parents tend to go to send their children to schools where the teacher is the authority and the teacher teaches subjects and has possibly not gone through teacher training college. And perhaps the way forward is basically to give parents the means to go and purchase school places at schools of their choice, and then schools would actually have to conform to what parents want. And generally what parents want is for teachers to be authorities, both in the sense of being authoritative and having control over the class.
Okay, thank you. Frank, anything you want to pick up?
Yeah, 3 points. On this last point, one of the problems is that with the collapse of adult authority, a lot of parents find it very difficult to accept that teachers being authoritative towards their own child. On the one hand, they will say, I want the school to discipline my child, but that's a rhetorical statement. When it comes to their own child, they take a different view. So when little Mary doesn't get on the netball team, then mama goes there straight away, and even though little Mary is fat and slow and doesn't know how to play netball, nevertheless, she insists that she's going to be on the netball team. And you will find that these days, whenever teachers criticize children, parents become their kids' advocates and play a very good role in undermining teacher authority in the private sector as much as in the public sector. And I think one of the things you will find going on in the private sector is that teachers are even more scared of parents than in the public sector, because, you know, for obvious reasons. But the unfortunate thing in the private sector is, although on balance it's obviously better than the public sector, you do find the same problem, which is that the younger cohort of teachers got trained in the same places as the teachers in the state sector, and they're not any better. And you'll find that although there are the Westminster schools and the St. Paul's and all the rest of that, most in the private sector, you do have a very large tail of underperforming schools that are not particularly brilliant and are suffering from many of the same kind of problems. So I don't want us to have this image that there's a wonderful private sector and a horrible kind of public sector, or private sector is all that much better. It's better, and there are some very good schools there, but by and large, the problems that I'm describing also exist there, although in a much more muted, much more restrained way, and that I think needs to be kind of borne in mind. It seems to me that a lot of questions have been raised about the content of teaching, and there's one point that I think is quite important to kind of bear in mind, which is that when we talk about teaching children to think, What we are really are saying is that we're not teaching them content, as you were saying, but there's also this assumption that somehow we're freeing children from the constraints of didacticism, and that relates to your Latin school idea. And according to this pedagogy, in the old days, there used to be learning by rote, and now we've got this new liberal education where we don't teach kids by rote anymore. The reality is that if you look at schooling today in England, it is far more sort of learning by rote than it was in the Victorian era. That's the irony of it all, because the curriculum and testing and examinations so much dominates what is taught in the classroom that by the time kids get to their A-levels, they will have learned to study by rote in a way that's far more extreme than existed in the Victorian era, when learning by rote was actually kind of celebrated. So that's the irony of it all. I don't think we should be dismissal of all these different forms of trendy education like Steiner or the Emilio, whatever it's called. I was there the other week in Bologna, you know, sort of. And I mean, they're not my cup of tea. But I think that, you know, if that's what people want to do, that's fine. I mean, I've seen kids that are the product of Summerhill, which is about as anti-authoritarian as you can get. And they're pretty good kids. And the reason why they're pretty good kids is because the teachers there are very authoritative, right? I mean, you know, they are very, very authoritative. So I can live with any educational system, you know, sort of, as long as they're getting authoritative education there. And all that happens is that in these schools, there's this kind of pretend idea that children are allowed to discover stuff for themselves. But I can tell you that, you know, they're doing it by script. You know, I mean, children are not allowed to crawl on the street. You know, they're not allowed to do extremely dangerous things. It's just that it's a different philosophy, and I can live with that. I wouldn't want that my own child to go to a school like that, but there's no reason why you could not use those pedagogic techniques for positive outcomes, as long as you have authoritative teachers.
Okay, I've really got very little time, so I've got those two gentlemen there. I can't bring you in again. Those two gentlemen there, that lady there, and then I've got two quick at the back, and it's fast, fast, fast. Yes, sir.
Mark Taylor, I'm a school teacher and I'm from the Education Forum. Frank, I think in my school, I don't think anybody's in this room, they are in the conference, but they might have said, when you said the word shut up about a kid, and I think that one thing you might have missed or be missing in the angle that people take is, I know, they might say from our school, I'm not sure if I agree with Frank, but what I know he's wrong about is that he said shut up. Why couldn't he say be quiet? And because I think that's the level that it gets expressed at. And they might say they've got a solution for your identification of the authority problem, and it's in the language that you use, and that you need to reflect very carefully on the on the language you've used and come up with a way that might engage the children with what you're trying to do a bit more, and then maybe they might be on side. Now, is there any truth in that? Because that is a kind of, if you like, that's a new idea about how education should go. And it's really saying that psychology is the informal knowledge that we're all using in education at the moment, rather than whatever the explicit content is. I mean, Anna, is there any truth in it at all? You know, should you just say to me now, shut up, Mark, please?
Yeah, shut up, yeah. Mark, please. Right, okay, thank you.
I agree with most of what you said. I think that the book is a great step forward. I'm not sure. I think there is a bit of confusion about the curriculum. Some people have said that the curriculum is very... The government is imposing its own authority with the curriculum. I don't think that's true. If you actually read the curriculum, for example, the English curriculum, it's very vague. Teachers can choose whatever authors they want. There's a great choice. It's a myth that it imposes the authority of the government. Even the syllabus, which is more, because teachers have to teach the syllabus, the examination, not the curriculum, so it's more the actual curriculum is the syllabus. Even the syllabus, you can choose from a number of poets. You've got great choice as a teacher. So the problem with the curriculum for me is it is different from pedagogy, by the way. It's two different things. Pedagogy, I agree with you.
Just stick with
the curriculum. The inability of the educational establishment to decide what children should study, that is the central problem of education, in the sense that it expresses, it's the clearest expression of the crisis of authority. So in refusing to deal with that problem, are you evading the problem?
Okay, thanks. That lady there, and then the two gentlemen at the back, yeah.
Thank you. Shirley Laws, I'm one of the Institute of Ideas Education Forum members as well. as a teacher trainer myself, I'd like to agree with what you said about teacher training. I would like to be able to call it teacher education, but can't. But for the past 15 years, we've had a regime in operation that is actually designed, really, underneath it all, to produce teachers who may be basically competent at one level, but who are actually technical operators. And it's a whole culture of compliance and conformity that we have. And once you have teachers who see themselves in quite a different way and don't see teaching as having any real intellectual content in their professionalism, then clearly you need to have lots of policies in school that help them, that are designed to help them to keep discipline in the classroom and so on. And it's this sort of introduction of these formal procedures and policies that actually do undermine teachers. So on the one hand, they're designed supposedly to help these people who really don't think about what they're doing, I would argue. But at the same time, having to follow very rigid policies in terms of discipline about how you actually deal with a discipline issue in a classroom and has to be systematically followed and reported on is actually undermining of any sort of natural relationships that teachers might be developing with their pupils in the classroom. And that's what's being squeezed out, those sort of authentic human relationships between teachers and pupils.
Okay, thank you. So the two gentlemen, yeah.
Frank, I very much recognise the picture you painted, both as a father of a boy in secondary school and also as somebody who works in higher education, where I think quite similar trends are also apparent. But there's been an issue raised a couple of times in this discussion, which I don't think you've really addressed, and that is to do with the idea of passing on the legacy of the past. You presented it as a fairly straightforward proposition, but isn't it in fact quite problematic that it's not a new thing, that this is a highly politicised idea and it's a highly contested idea, what the legacy of the past is. And today it's also something about which there's a great deal of uncertainty. So in proposing that we refocus authority in education on transmitting that legacy between the generations, I think there's a bit more to be said about what that legacy actually entails.
No, the person in front of you, I think, is the last person.
Thank you. My question's kind of related to that, which is, do we need to have, or do you think we need to restore this positive view of knowledge and this positive attitude to education, some kind of vision of what it's for? Because it seems that with kind of negative views of science and a general feeling that we've got enough in society now, if you haven't got any future in mind, then why would you bother with the past, the legacy of the past? So not even that it's contested, but why would people even feel that they need to bring the past forward to build on if you're not even bothered about building something? It kind of seems, I just wonder if you think we need some kind of vision.
I just want to say something. I get to go and give a lot of speeches to sixth formers, get invited once, not always invited back. One of the things that I try and pursue, look at in different ways, is I try and say to the sixth formers that they should be wary of and avoid false flattery from adults who tell them how wonderful they are. And that actually, when people say the pupil's voice is interesting, that maybe it isn't that interesting, and maybe this is more to do with the crisis of adult authority. And sometimes it goes down well, and sometimes it doesn't. And understandably, if you're 16 to, 18, and you've got me saying your voice isn't that interesting, it can be a bit dispiriting and annoying, and certainly clashes with what, culturally what else is going on. But one thing I try and say to them, and I suppose this is actually genuine, is the pupil voice thing is actually rubbish. It really is insulting to young people, Because, you know, tell me what pupil committee in a school today has got a policy saying, yes, let's all go binge drinking on a Friday night. Let's do graffiti all over the playground. In other words, they trot out the banalities of New Labour policy or what the teachers want. I've never heard an original pupil voice policy emerge from anywhere. And what I actually think we have to really expose is that this that is done in the name of pupil voice and the abdication of adult responsibility does pupils and young people no favours whatsoever. No adults are interested in listening to those young people. They're just using them as a stage army. And the second thing I'd say is that I think that parents are constantly used as a stage army against teachers' authority as well. The number of times that teachers are told that they are not allowed to be authoritative in the classroom because the parents have complained, that is an increasing phenomena. A collapse of solidarity between two different groups of adults, with the teachers and the parents pointing fingers at each other and saying, I don't trust you to be authoritative, I don't trust you to be authoritative. And that's one of another destructive trend. Frank, your final thoughts, please.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's probably the weakest plank of the Tory education policy, the belief that you can rely on pushy parents to deliver the results. It will completely disorient teachers and undermine education even more. We already have far too many pushy parents, as it happens, so it's not a problem. On the legacy of the past, the way that I look at it is that legacy of the past is always contested. There's no doubt about that. But I would rather have the legacy of past contested because both sides or different sides think that it's important. And that's the way it's been in the last two, three, four centuries. Then today, when we argue that the legacy of the past is not important to even contest, and therefore we can just leave it behind. So what I'm really arguing, I'm not arguing for a particular version of the past. I'm arguing for the past to be taken seriously. And I'm quite open for people in this room to put forward, for example, their view of history, their view of which bits of science, bits of literature need to be taken seriously, as long as we can argue about it, rather than to argue that we just got to leave all that behind and look in a different direction altogether. On the curriculum, I mean, the way that I look at it is that the curriculum, like virtually everything else we've discussed, is open to debate. There is no simple black and white solution. There's nothing wrong with a curriculum, right? Absolutely nothing wrong with a national curriculum. And in certain circumstances, it can play a really valuable role. There's a lot that's wrong with this national curriculum, and that's not just simply because of the curriculum, but the fact that it's essentially a managerial tool rather than an educative tool. I think that's really where the problem lies. And I think we should really get more relaxed about almost everything that we're debating, because in principle, you know, we can deal with those things as intelligent adults. The real problem are the underlying issues, which is to do with the meaning of education, the intellectual content of education, and the authority of knowledge and the authority of adults. Those are the key things that we need to really kind of be concerned with. And yes, I do reflect on my self-esteem issues. You're absolutely right, and I should do that. And maybe when I become middle-aged, like some people in the audience, you know, then I'll be able to speak in a better language.
Thank you. Okay, listen, thanks, Frank. Frank will be signing his book in foils 3 till 3:30. He'll be back on this stage in 15 minutes. And there's plenty more education debates on science teaching today, and the empty staff room has teaching lost its magic first thing tomorrow. So thank you very much indeed.